Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season with a program titled Simply Classical, featuring the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, with soloists performing the Mozart Requiem, along with the Beethoven Symphony No. 8. Well, my guest today is the guest conductor for the concert, but no stranger to Tulsa. James Bagwell was the music director for Light Opera Oklahoma for a number of years, conducting some 25 productions for the company. Today, he's the chairman of the music program at Bard College, leads the choral and conducting departments there. He's also the director of choruses for the prestigious Bard Summer Music Festival, where he guest conducts. He's also a principal guest conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra, chorus master for the Mostly Mozart Festival at Lincoln Center, and often rehearses choruses for appearances with the New York Philharmonic and other metropolitan orchestras in New York. He's also the music director of the Collegiate Chorale, which performs at Carnegie Hall and Alice Tully Hall in New York. Despite that schedule, he still has time to return to Tulsa from time to time to lead the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He'll do just that with the Mozart Requiem and the Beethoven Symphony No. 8 this Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. James Bagwell, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's good to talk with you.
Nice to be back.
And I guess it is kind of this way because you know so many of these musicians from your time with Look and, of course, guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony. I guess that's one of the great things about guest conducting at a place over and over again. You get to really know the musicians almost as if they're your own musicians.
Well, I looked out last night at the first rehearsal and I thought, oh yeah, we did this together. We did Sweeney Todd together. We did Pirates of Penzance together. So it's I always feel like the musicians in Tulsa really taught me how to conduct. So I have a real affection for these musicians and this orchestra in particular.
But nowadays in New York, you're an incredibly busy gentleman with, I think you have a number of choirs. You're preparing choirs for big orchestra concerts with the New York Philharmonic or the Mostly Mozart Festival, as well as the Bard Festival where you teach. You're incredibly busy. And this particular program sort of combines some of the things you're doing.
And that's
orchestra
right.
Conducting as well as leading these big, massive pieces like the Requiem.
Right. This is true. I've been doing a little more orchestral conducting recently. And then to work on a piece as iconic as the Mozart Requiem is just great fun. And you're right. It's a great combination of what I've been doing recently.
You know, this piece is a wonderful piece. People who are not familiar with it, it is so stirring. It can be so moving by turns. It can be, it is almost this incredible fire to it that we don't associate with Mozart as much.
Well, Mozart was going through, it's one of the last things he wrote. He never finished the piece. And Mozart was going through a stylistic change, almost looking back. For example, the orchestration at the beginning uses organ, and which is something you don't see in Mozart's music at the end. Low winds, clarinets, bassoons at the beginning, trombones doubling the voices. It's a very sort of archaic sound. So it sort of has an early music sound about it. So Mozart's reaching back into the past, and he quotes Handel's "And with his stripes we are healed" from the second part of a Messiah. And there are other little musical quotes within the piece. So Mozart's almost acting like a historian in a way through this piece, which was very unusual for him.
Now, is that something you have to prepare for as a conductor when you have to know that there's little lift from Handel and things like that in this piece?
That's the fun detective work. This is something that composers did a lot in the 18th and 19th century. They would borrow from themselves and they would borrow from each other. This was before copyright laws. In a sense, it's the same thing as one samples in music today. So Mozart samples not only from Handel but also from Bach as well. So plus Mozart's, I think, really finding a new depth in his sound, and particularly in the way he writes counterpoint, that is to say the relationship between voices. It's very dense, very elastic, and sort of taffy pull kind of sound, you know.
Well, how do you approach this particular piece for yourself?
I try to think about the piece as being more related to Bach and Handel and less related to early Beethoven. I'm looking for a sound that one might associate with something called the early music sound, a little less vibrato from the strings, less vibrato from the chorus, and maybe tempo is just a little bit brisker than what you might what one might normally associate with the piece.
Now, why do you like that a particular approach for this? Do you tend towards early music? I'm not aware of that.
Well, not necessarily. I just think it sort of cleans it up a little bit, and it takes out some of the – I mean, the piece is already so layered with mythology, and this sort of takes out some of that, and I think in a sense humanizes the piece somewhat.
So, again, when I think of this piece, it's also a little bit dense because you do have brass players doubling the vocal lines. How do you work through that?
Well, you balance the trombones are often the ones doubling the vocal parts.
Yeah, we're always in trouble.
That's right. And that goes back much earlier, actually. Bach did this.
Right, you know? Trombones play the chorus lines.
And so it was not only a way of supporting the lines, but it colors the sound. And I think the trombones doubling the chorus is just as important as the chorus. The only difference is they don't have the words. So we have to find a way to get the trombones to play the words and get the chorus to sing the trombone part so that there's a unanimity of sound there.
Yeah. Of course, the one thing I love about this piece is it can just storm at one moment and then it's just this beautiful ethereal parts.
Well, the Dies Irae is the one that I think is associated most with the piece, and this thing is the poem itself, the Dies Irae poem, which is the Day of Wrath, Day of Judgment text, which they think it was written by a Franciscan who are not necessarily generally known for the sort of fire and brimstone, but now there's talk that it might have been written by a Benedictine monk, so we don't know for sure. But nevertheless, it's sort of this masterpiece of sort of torture and cannibalistic excitement, in the words of Robert Shaw. And Mozart, you know, sets this beautifully. In fact, he was the first one to really set it in an operatic style, which then influenced composers like Berlioz and Verdi and others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit of that Dies Irae. This is from the Mozart Requiem, one of the pieces to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, and my guest today, guest conductor James Bagwell, who returns to Tulsa to lead the Tulsa Symphony this Saturday night. Here's music by Mozart. That's music from the Mozart Requiem, one of the two pieces that will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night at 7:30. They'll be joined by the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, and my guest today is James Bagwell, who will be guest conducting. He is the chair of the music department at Bard College, also the director of the choral activities there. He's very much involved with the Bard Festival, which is a big, huge music festival in the summertime, and leading choruses for mostly Mozart and running his own choruses, just a very busy guy. And we remember him from being the music director at Look for many years.
10 years.
10 years, yeah. And he's back in Tulsa for this concert this weekend. Well, the other piece on the concert, which is really it's an interesting choice of putting the Mozart Requiem and the Beethoven Eighth.
Yes, it's a very interesting choice. Because as I said earlier, the Mozart Requiem sort of looks back. In many ways, Beethoven's Eighth Symphony looks back as well. But it looks back with sort of a different perspective. It's as though Beethoven is sort of trying to suppress his 18th century classical tendencies with this upcoming Ninth Symphony. Now, of course, we have no way of knowing what's on the man's mind. He wrote the piece in 1812, which was a stormy political time. And it was a stormy time in Beethoven's life. Wrote it in about 4 months. On the surface, the piece is very sunny, very playful. But underneath that is something a little bit more desperate in the piece. He's trying very hard to be in a good mood. And I think in 1812, when he wrote the piece, he still had some hearing. By 1814, when he conducted it, and on that same concert, by the way, in 1814, was his 7th symphony, his 8th symphony, and Wellington's Victory, which Beethoven conducted all three of those works, and he was pretty much deaf. The hearing was gone at this point.
Did he have somebody to help him?
I don't know. I mean, he stood there. I mean, I'm sure he stood there very authoritatively, and it's hard to know, you know, exactly what he actually could hear at this point.
You know, when I think of these symphonies, you know, you think of 5, mm-hmm. 6, 7, and then 8 is almost in many ways a throwback in many ways.
Yeah, Beethoven was asked this question. Somebody said, you know, this 8th is not as popular. Why is it? And he said, well, because it's one of my best pieces. Which I thought was a typical sort of Beethovenian answer. And in many ways it is. It's a real distilled piece. It's not very long. It's about 25 minutes long. Each movement is very compact, but there's a lot of energy and there's a lot going on within each movement.
Now, I may be getting my music wrong, but isn't there a minuet in the 8th?
Yeah, there's a third movement minuet.
Well, he'd abandoned the minuet.
He had, and you can't dance to it. It's almost as though he's written a minuet that one can't dance to. It's written for people like me who couldn't dance a minuet. So all the accents are in the wrong place, which is part of the sort of the gag of the piece, is part of the joke. It's a very jokey kind of piece in a way. The second movement also has all these very funny little interjections. And someday I'm going to teach a course on humor in music. And if I do, that's going to be one of the pieces that I use because it does have this great sort of charming sense of humor.
And as a conductor, do you have to play that up?
I have to play it up. I just have to make the piece sound clear. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I get out of the way, Beethoven's humor doesn't need any of my help. It's pretty good on its own.
Really?
But there are little things here and there that I can highlight to bring out some of the humor in the piece. Yeah. It's a great foil to the Mozart Requiem, which, of course, is a very profoundly, in many ways, a very sad piece. And then this 8th symphony, which is Beethoven dealing with a sense of humor that one often feels is oppressed by himself, that he himself doesn't want to admit to having a sense of humor. But he does, certainly in this piece.
And, you know, now that you think about it, you know, the seventh, which was, you know, has that great middle movement,
yeah,
you know, which has all this drama. But the rest of the symphony has a fairly sunny disposition.
It does.
And maybe this was a sort of a part of that as
I
well.
I think so. Maybe
you know, it's so difficult in ascribing motives to what
right.
Beethoven was thinking and doing. You know, it's just great music.
It's hard to get into the mind of the composer, especially in that period. You know, in the 19th century, We sort of had an idea about how Verdi felt about things, or even Berlioz felt.
Emotions are on the sleeve.
Yeah, but with Beethoven, he was still sort of on both sides of the door about how much emotion he was willing to show or play, and how much he was keeping to himself. And the 8th is one of those pieces.
Why don't you tell us about a moment in the symphony you think people ought to be listening for in the 8th?
In the last movement, which is in F major, he keeps sort of blasting away on this C sharp, and it's almost as though you almost think of it if a car horn existed in the early 19th century, it would sound like that. So the thing will be going along da 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 da, and then he just keeps going through it over and over and over again. It's this kind of thing that I find so interesting about the piece. He'll go on with what you think of as sort of a typical classical melody, you know, and then suddenly interrupt it with almost this shout. And you hear that a lot in Beethoven's music. Beethoven shouts at us quite a bit. You know, think of the last movement of the 9th symphony where he could say Freude, joy, in a much nicer way. Instead, it's more like a command. And this is one of the moments in the piece like that.
Well, let's hear that. That's this music from the Beethoven Symphony No. 8, one of two works to be played by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this weekend. Thank you. That's music from the Beethoven Symphony No. 8. My guest today is the guest conductor for the concert, James Bagwell, who returns to Tulsa to lead the orchestra not only in the Beethoven Symphony No. 8, but the Mozart Requiem. Mm-hmm. And as we speak on Thursday, you'll be seeing the chorus for the first time tonight. When you come in as a guest conductor, do you have any preparation with the chorus? Or you just hope that they're doing the things you want them to
do. I know that they're in good hands with Tim Sharp, so I have no worries there. I also prepare an audition for them. So I send them all my breath marks, dynamic markings, articulations well in advance so that they know what to expect from me. Mm-hmm. So that saves an enormous amount of time.
And that's something you do a lot.
Yeah.
Or you receive them from conductors when you're preparing choruses.
I do a lot of choral preparation, so I know what it's like to be on the other side of things. And the more specific information that the chorus has, the easier it is for them to get down to the business of making the music rather than worrying about where that cutoff is.
Now, is that pretty standard procedure in the orchestra world, or does it vary from conductor to conductor?
It varies from conductor to conductor. If it's a conductor with whom I've done a lot of concerts, we kind of know. If it's someone new, then I'll do a little investigation and a phone call or an email or something and find out, well, how do you prefer? What kind of sound do you want? If it's in Latin, what kind of Latin do you want? Do you want a German pronunciation of Latin or an Italianate pronunciation of Latin? And I've learned as I've gotten older the questions to ask of various conductors.
Was that a learning process in and of itself?
I found out once that a chorus went to the Verbier Festival doing a mass. It was a Haydn mass or a Schubert mass, and the conductor said, okay, here we go. He started. And he said, you're doing it in the wrong pronunciation of the Latin. And I took that little moment and put it in the back of my head. Fortunately, it didn't happen to me. But then I learned that's one of the questions you ask, is the particular pronunciation. Even Carmina Burana has different pronunciations of the Latin. It can be in German Latin. It can be in Italianate Latin. And
how different are the? This is total ignorance on my part.
Well,
big is the difference in pronunciation?
For instance, in Italianate Latin, the word Kyrie, which means Lord, it's actually a Greek word, and you'll hear this word quite a bit in the Mass. The Italianate is Kyrie. The German is Kyrie. And the word credo, which means I believe, in Latin, the Italianate is credo. In the German, it's credo. So it's very close, different regional ways of speaking. You know, it has to do with regionality. And then early in the 20th century, the Vatican decided that it was time to unify the pronunciation of Latin, and it being the Vatican, Italian was chosen. Not everyone chose that particular
Perhaps
version.
Your Germanic conductors are still resistant.
Yeah, and actually, you know, sometimes you hear this German Latin, it actually makes sense. It's a different sound. And for some choruses, it takes a while to get used to, but the inflection, it's subtle, but it really can sort of get the idea of how the composer envisioned it.
So if you're singing the Verdi Requiem, mm-hmm. the Mozart Requiem, mm-hmm. and the Berlioz Requiem, mm-hmm. that's
three,
German, yeah. Austria, that's Italian, and French. Mm-hmm. The pronunciations are going to be a little different for each?
It depends on the conductor.
But if the conductor, let's say he's French or Italian or German, he's going to want that different sound?
I had an experience with Riccardo Muti at the Salzburg Festival a few years back, and we were doing the Verdi Requiem. And, you know, I think that Riccardo Muti has a direct line between Verdi and the current day. And we kept mispronouncing Donna, D-O-N-A, and he kept hearing it as D-O-N-N-A, which is Donna in Italian. And so he kept on about this one little detail because in his ear he was hearing Donna instead of Donna, which sounds like too subtle to be believed, but it does make an impact.
You know? Is the music written so that different pronunciation does make a difference in the whole way it's carried out?
I think sometimes. I think composers have a lot on their minds, and I'm not sure that they've given that their fullest thought, and it's left up to us as stewards to this music to try to see, well, does it make sense to follow, you know, these very specific rules or expectations? I hate the word rules. Expectations is better. And, you know, at the end of the day, what we really want to do is really express the profundity, the beauty, the excitement of the music. That's really what we want to try to do. And if doing it in those particular pronunciations help us get to that end, so be it. We're doing the Mozart Requiem in just sort of typical, what we call normal Latin.
American Latin.
American Latin or Italianate Latin, just like what one speaks at home. Yeah. So,
my guest today is James Bagwell, who will be leading the Tulsa Symphony and the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus in the Mozart Requiem and the Beethoven Symphony No. 8 this Saturday night at 7:30, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, since you've been at Bard, you've been very much involved in the musical activities. When you have a president that is actually a conductor mm-hmm. and composer, there's a lot of music at the school, and you have a big role in the festival each summer, which is a major festival mm-hmm. in which you do the festival unearths old manuscripts, oftentimes right. revives pieces that have just been gathering dust and to great critical acclaim. What's going on with the festival at this point?
This summer is Chavez. It's our first Mexican composer, and Chavez was a very influential teacher. Copland knew him, and he sort of developed a school of Mexican composers that we don't know in this country at all. So this is really music of the Americas, but not the United States, but further south. And it looks to be a really great festival. We're still putting together programming. We're looking at some music that was actually brought to the what was not then the United States, but now the United States missions out in the West that was in the style of Renaissance choral music, in the style of Palestrina or Victoria and others. And it should be a fascinating festival, I think. It's our first foray into this particular kind of repertoire.
You know, that was a revelation to me not too long ago, the fact that as the music of, say, the 16th century mm-hmm. and 15th century, well, especially the 16th century, was here in the New World as well as it was in
yeah.
Europe.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, even the Moravians in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, they brought in, when they came to this country, they brought in tons of music in the style of Haydn, including manuscripts by Haydn. And so they were performing essentially 18th century classical music in a culture at that time which had no idea what that music was.
Which, yeah, might be a wooden cabin.
Right, right.
In the woods.
And so, yeah, the way that the European music imported into this country was a good thing and a bad thing. You know, I think that we've, as a country, suffered a little bit from anxiety of influence, as it were. And but it's awfully fun to get an idea about what the 16th century, 17th century people living in the Americas were performing as what we could consider classical music or something of that nature, not folk music.
Now, another one of your hats is to prepare choruses for big orchestral choral events in mm-hmm. New York City. You do it, I think, New York Philharmonic? Or
I work with the New York Philharmonic. I work consistently with mostly Mozart Festival, and I also prepare choruses for the American Symphony Orchestra as well. So,
which runs.
Leon Botstein is the music director, and I'm the principal guest conductor
That's
for
right.
the orchestra. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do a lot of these, and with the American Symphony Orchestra in particular, I get to do works that I probably will only do once in my life, and they're works that I've always wanted to do, but it's often very hard to, find the funding or find a reason. It's a very conservative business out there, the classical world, and so the American Symphony sort of prides itself in doing works that would otherwise not be done. Mm-hmm. And that's fun for me.
Give us a sense of something you've done that you'll probably only do once and
something that's
coming up.
I hope I do it again and again, and that's the Ligeti Requiem. And if the listeners out there know the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, this music is used quite prominently, much to the composer's chagrin. but I'll very quickly explain to you how the piece is put together. It's divided into five sections within a chorus: soprano, mezzo-soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. And then with each one of those sections, it divides itself four ways. So there's soprano 1, 2, 3, 4, mezzo 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And they're all moving at different speeds, at different rates of speed, often moving at melodic ideas of half steps, which is the smallest interval that we normally accept in Western music. So this thing is unbelievably difficult, maybe one of the hardest pieces on the planet, and we just did it in December. And it was one of the most gratifying things I've ever done in my life, and I hope to do it again. To give you an example, the full score is about the length of an average-size carry-on bag that you could take on an airplane.
Wow.
It's huge. It's like a studio apartment in New York. And to sort of work on a piece that's so dense, yet in its density, in its intellectual complexities, is extraordinarily emotional.
Now, you mentioned 2001. If I remember right, that's that sort of almost minimalistic sort of passage where it's just like a vocal that just sort of grows in intensity.
That's right.
The tension of it is just so impressive.
I believe it comes at the end of the movie, and the words are, ironically enough, the Kyrie eleison that we were just talking about earlier. Uh-huh. It's an extraordinary achievement by a composer who was grappling with the notion of how do you write music after the Holocaust? What do you do? You can't write beautiful music. It's very difficult. Yeah. And so... He takes the ideas of modernity and is then able to make it something very, very human, I think.
Now, besides this weekend's performances, what are you looking forward to in your own schedule?
In about 2.5-3 weeks, I'm doing a Handel oratorio, Susanna, which is his third from the end, and it's based on the part of Daniel in which Susanna, who is the bride, as her husband leaves to go on essentially a business trip. I don't know what a biblical business trip would be. Anyway, so Susanna is spotted by these two lecherous old men.
Susanna and the Elders.
That's exactly right. Uh-huh. And was adopted later by Carlisle Floyd. And the theme of that was. And so it's kind of a riot of an oratorio. It's religious in nature, but it's pretty close to an opera. And we're doing that at Town Hall in February, and that's sort of the next thing that's coming up.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that with the performance this weekend. Jim, it's always good to talk with you.
Thanks. Nice talking with you. Thank you, Rich.
James Bagwell returns to Tulsa to lead the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night at 7:30 in a program featuring the Mozart Requiem along with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus and Soloist and the Beethoven Symphony No. 8. The concert takes place Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapin Music Hall. For information about the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. We're going to leave you with a little more music from the Beethoven Symphony No. 8. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.